Unit 16. Part 1. The Effects of the Moon. The Earth's moon, which has always been an object of worship and mystery to the people of all cultures and religions, is located an average of 239,000 miles from the Earth. It has a diameter of 2,136 miles, and its gravity is 1/6 that of Earth's. Scientists know that the moon, as well as the sun, affects the ocean's tides. It is also possible that the moon is related to the occurrence of earthquakes. But today, we are going to discuss another fascinating question with respect to the moon. Does it affect our behavior? To begin with, many observers say that the moon's phases definitely affect the behavior of animals. For example, fishermen know that fish are easier or harder to catch depending on what stage the moon is in. But what about people? Carl Sagan, the famous astronomer, says, "I have no doubt the moon has an effect on human behavior." There are stories in almost every society about people who do strange and unpredictable things during the time of the full moon, which comes approximately every 29 days. Is there really a connection? Well, one person who believes that the answer to this question is yes is Dr. Arnold Lieber, a psychiatrist in Miami. He has written a book called The Lunar Effect, in which he points out that crime rates seem to increase at the time of the full moon. For example, a woman named Sarah Jane Moore tried to kill former President Gerald Ford during a full moon. Patricia Hearst, the famous heiress, was also kidnapped by a group of terrorists at this time. Dr. Lieber also believes that the full moon is linked to depression in many people. In fact, he points out that in 1977, 9 people committed suicide by jumping off San Francisco's Golden Gate Bridge during full moons. In Los Angeles, some members of the police and fire departments agree that the full moon is associated with more crime and unusual behavior. According to the fire department, the highest number of car accidents occurs on 2 occasions: when welfare checks are distributed and when the moon is full. A Los Angeles police sergeant named Bob Kenny is convinced that the full moon has some effects on people, though he agrees that this is very hard to prove. Still, according to the Los Angeles Times of January 20, 1984, he says that most of the police officers he knows believe there is a connection between crime rates and the full moon. Many airline pilots, waitresses, bartenders, and newspaper reporters, all of whom deal directly with the public, agree that people behave oddly during periods of the full moon, though they can't specify exactly how or why it happens. But of course, there are also plenty of people who disagree. Los Angeles Police Sergeant Dwayne Rasher says that people can behave oddly at any time. He says his workload is no heavier during the full moon. Bar owner Jim Foley agrees with Rasher. "People can be erratic at any time," he says. You might want to check the calendar and find out when the full moon will occur in the next few months. During those times, observe the behavior of your family and friends and see if they do anything that is unexplainable or unusual. In the meantime, if it turns out that the moon really does make us all act strangely, let's be thankful that we live on Earth with its one moon and not on Saturn, which has 22 moons, or Jupiter, which has 4 major moons and 12 minor ones. Part 2. The Bermuda Triangle.
On December 5, 1945, at 2 o'clock p.m., a group of 5 United States Navy airplanes took off in perfect weather for a practice flight over the Atlantic Ocean. 2 hours later, the captain of the group, Lieutenant Charles Taylor, radioed back that he was completely lost. He said that the plane's compasses were going crazy and that he could see no land. And then his radio died. The Navy sent another plane to search for the missing group, but it disappeared too. By the end of the day, 6 airplanes and 27 men had disappeared in a mysterious area known as the Bermuda Triangle. This is just one of the many frightening stories that people love to tell about the Bermuda Triangle, which is located in the West Atlantic Ocean between Miami, Florida, the island of Bermuda, and the island of Puerto Rico. Over the years, more than 100 planes, ships, and small boats, and more than 1,000 people have been lost in this area. And in most cases, to make the stories even more mysterious, no wreckage or survivors have ever been found. The planes and ships have simply disappeared. There is no doubt that there is something strange, perhaps even mysterious, about this part of the Atlantic. The question is, what is it? How can we explain the disappearance of so many ships and planes in this region? In this lecture, we will examine some of the official, as well as the more imaginative, explanations that people have offered over the years. The United States Navy does not believe that there is anything mysterious about the triangle. It says that all the accidents are the result of the special geographical features of this area. These features include the Gulf Stream current, which flows rapidly through the area, many underwater canyons, and changeable, often violent, weather patterns. In addition, the triangle has an unusual magnetic characteristic that causes compasses in this area to point to true north instead of magnetic north. If the navigator of a ship or plane forgets this fact, he can easily get lost in the Bermuda Triangle. The Navy believes that this is probably what happened to the 5 Navy airplanes that I mentioned at the beginning of this talk. In conclusion, the Navy believes that the disappearances of so many ships and planes can be explained by human error, changing weather, or magnetic abnormalities. Some of the other theories concerning the many accidents in the Triangle are a little bit difficult to believe. For example, John Wallace Spencer, who wrote a book called Limbo of the Lost, believes that creatures from outer space have established a civilization in the Triangle's underwater canyons, which have never been explored. He thinks that these alien creatures wanted human beings for their underwater zoo, and that they caused the disappearances. A similar theory states that the planes and ships disappeared because unidentified flying objects from outer space, UFOs, attacked them. People who believe this theory refer to the fact that many of the missing planes and ships reported seeing strange white lights before they suddenly disappeared. As you can see, there are many theories to explain the strange things that have happened in the Bermuda Triangle. There have been many books and TV shows about this subject, and there was even a special exposition at the Library of Congress. Nevertheless, thousands of people continue to travel in this popular area. Do these tourists ever wonder if they, too, will disappear in the depths of the Bermuda Triangle?
Part 3. Friends of the Earth.
So, Jonathan Porritt, you're the director of Friends of the Earth, is that right?
That's right. Have been for 3 years.
And what exactly is Friends of the Earth?
It's a campaigning pressure group dealing with a whole series of environmental issues. Some of those are international issues, such as the protection of the rainforests or acid rain. Some are to do with national concerns, such as planning policy or protection of the countryside. A lot of the things that we're involved in are to do with people's ordinary backyard environment, as it were. Small-scale things, like what the individual can do on recycling, or just improving the quality of their own environment. So it covers a wide range of different issues, all the way up, if you like, from the very small personal concerns right through to the biggest international issues.
About big international issues, what do you see as the most important environmental issues of the moment?
It's quite difficult to make a kind of hierarchy of worry here, because so many issues are there, and they're all very, very important. But I think it has to be said that as far as we're concerned, as a campaigning organization, it really is the rainforest that we are concentrating on most. If we don't take action on that issue within the next 5 years, then environmental pressure groups won't have anything to do in 10 years' time, because there won't be any rainforests, really, for them to campaign about. So this is a critical period for the rainforests. the next 5 years, and there is enough flexibility in the system to allow us to hope that we're going to be able to make some changes during that time. So that's why we've made it our priority.
What's so important about the rainforests, then? What's the difference between having them or not having them? Isn't it just, you know, basically either there's a lot of trees there or there aren't a lot of trees there?
Well, that's what some people would like to think. I think President Reagan was famous for saying, "Seen one tree, seen them all." And basically, this is not the attitude that we have. It's important in many different ways. Important, firstly, for the countries themselves, in terms of the fact that millions of people depend on the rainforests for their livelihood, and for the quality of their environment, through the protection of watersheds, and so on. Secondly, they're important because of the biological richness of the rainforests. A treasure chest, is how they have been described. More than 60% of the world's species is to be found in the rainforests. Write that off, and you write off the genetic storehouse. Lastly, they're important at an international level because of the impact on climatic patterns that one would find if the rainforests were destroyed. So whether you're looking closely at the tribal people who depend on them, the countries which depend on them, the international community which depends on them, indeed, the creatures themselves, it's actually the most critical issue that we face. And our prime job is, of course, to try and get people to understand how it is, even in countries where there are no rainforests, that they still have a connection with the rainforests. Part 4. Acid Rain. I'm going to talk about acid rain, a subject which many people have heard of, but very few understand fully. I'm going to talk about exactly what acid rain is and why it's a problem, and then I'm going to finish off by saying what we can do about it, what the solutions are now, and what the solutions will be in the future, in the long term. So, first of all, acid rain is a term that's really being used now for a kind of pollution which is hanging over our heads, in a sense. It's the air pollution above us. It's the pollution that's coming down in rain, in mist, in snow, in hail, in many different ways, and damaging our forests, our lakes and rivers, our buildings, and even human health. If we are to control acid rain, we must know what is actually causing it. So now I'm going to talk about the chemicals involved. There are really three we should look at. These are sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, and ozone. The first two of those are primary pollutants. That is, they are produced directly from source. In the case of sulfur dioxide, the main problem is power station chimneys. In the case of nitrogen oxides, they come really half and half from cars and from power stations. Ozone is what's known as a secondary pollutant. It means it's formed in the atmosphere from a combination of other pollutants, other primary pollutants. Ozone is formed from a combination of nitrogen oxides and hydrocarbons, both of which come from car exhausts. If you put sunlight onto these two chemicals, they react together and they form ozone, and so the highest levels of ozone are found in a hot summer around the edges of cities where there are lots of car exhausts, lots of sunlight, and then you end up with a lot of ozone. I think the one that most people would associate with acid rain, if they know anything about it at all, is sulfur, and particularly sulfur dioxide. About 71% of all sulfur dioxide emitted from Britain comes from the large coal-burning power stations predominantly situated in the Midlands. In fact, Britain is Western Europe's largest emitter of sulfur dioxide. We put out some 3.7 million tons a year. That's more than any other country, except perhaps Poland or Russia, if you go to the East Bloc. The problem, of course, with sulfur dioxide is that it doesn't fall close to the factory or the power station. It gets lifted into the air, and it can travel thousands of miles in the air before it falls as rain. So we're not just creating a problem for ourselves. We're creating a problem for the rest of Europe. And that is really why the Scandinavians and the Dutch and the Belgians have become angry with the British government, because it hasn't done anything about acid rain, because they are paying for the environmental damage which is caused by our pollution. But we shouldn't think that all our pollution goes out of the country. Our environment is dying as well, and sulfur from our power stations is landing all over the United Kingdom. In Wales and in the west of Scotland, acid rain is already having quite a marked effect. Some hundreds of lakes in Wales have been affected. Several have lost their fish, and in the west of Scotland, 27 Galloway lakes have already completely lost their fish. Now, perhaps I should go on to some of the solutions that we should be looking to stop this environmental catastrophe. There are short-term solutions, and there are long-term solutions. In the short term, we need to make immediate cuts to the emissions that are coming from our power stations and cars. In the long term, we need to change the way society is thinking. Many people have heard of the 30% Club. This is a group of now some 22 nations which have agreed to cut their sulfur emissions by 30% on 1980 levels by the year 1993. Britain hasn't yet joined the 30% Club. Some of the other countries that have are Sweden, Norway, Canada, West Germany, the Netherlands. Even Russia has joined the 30% Club. This is only the first step on the road to effective sulfur emission control. And what we really want to see is reductions of between 60 and 90% over the next 10 years or so. And looking to the longer term, we shouldn't just rely on solutions that involve a technological fix. We shouldn't just clean up power station chimneys and car exhausts. What we need to do is change the way society thinks and reacts. The first thing that needs to be done is we need to use less energy. One way of using less energy is to increase recycling, and so recycling schemes and reuse of materials should be encouraged throughout Europe and North America. Secondly, we have to change our transport system. We have to look for a more efficient transport system which relies less on individuals' use of cars and more on a good public transporter network. These are the things we must be looking forward to. Unless we do that, unless we change society in this way, conserve energy, rationalize our way of transport, and now clean up our power stations and individual cars, then we're bound to see more and worse environmental effects from air pollution and acid rain. We must act now.
Part 5. Cigarette smoking. Cigarette smoking is the greatest preventable cause of illness and death in Britain. It is associated with around 110,000 premature deaths and an estimated 50 million lost working days each year, and costs the National Health Service an estimated £10 million a year for the treatment of related diseases. For example, heart disease, lung cancer, and bronchitis. In addition, smoking by pregnant women can cause low birth weight in infants. The government is following an active health education policy, supported by voluntary agreements with the tobacco industry, aimed at reducing the level of smoking. The government aims to reduce adult smoking in England from the present 30% to 20% by the year 2000. A further aim has been to reduce smoking by young people by one-third between 1988 and the end of 1994. Smoking is also being tackled as a priority in Wales, Scotland, and Northern Ireland, and similar targets have been set for the year 2000. A three-year national campaign, costing £4 million a year, started in 1994. Aimed at adult smokers, particularly parents, the campaign will emphasize the dangers of passive smoking. It will be backed up by local activities to help people to stop smoking. Education on the harmful effects of smoking is included in the national curriculum for all pupils in publicly maintained schools in England and Wales. The government also supports the work of the voluntary organization Action on Smoke and Health, whose services include a workplace service consultancy offering advice and help to employers in formulating anti-smoking policies. The government is committed to creating a smoke-free environment with facilities where appropriate for those who wish to smoke, and has published a code of practice on smoking in public places. Health authorities have been asked to promote non-smoking as the normal practice in health service buildings, and to give help and advice to people who want to give up smoking. The Independent Scientific Committee on Smoking and Health estimated that passive smoking, especially in the workplace and the home, may cause several hundred deaths through lung cancer every year. 1. How is this government's health education policy reacted to by the tobacco industry? 2. How much does the government aim to reduce adult smoking in England by the year 2000? 3. Which of the following is not listed as a disease related to smoking? 4. How much does the government aim to reduce smoking by young people between 1988 and 1994? 5. According to a scientific committee, how many deaths are caused by passive smoking through lung cancer every year?
Part 6. Listening and Translation. 1. Sentence Translation.
1. Could we have a quick word about the sales conference? I'd like to see everything will be okay by the end of this month.
2. As you can see, sales have risen gradually over the last 5 years. This growth has largely been due to the record levels of pay rise we have enjoyed in recent years.
3. I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Smith Johnson from Market Intelligence. He has been doing a lot of research into where we should be advertising.
4. Good afternoon, and welcome to the Ideal Home Exhibition. Catalogs are on sale at all entrances for £1.40. We hope you enjoy your visit to the exhibition today.
5. This is a very friendly office. I think it helps having a lot of girls roughly the same age, and as you can see, there seem to be quite a lot of fun and laughs.
2. Passage Translation.
1. A far-reaching development in post-war America was the growing mobility of people. Americans became increasingly able and willing to move from place to place. In earlier times, when life was simpler, large numbers of Americans had lived their lives in the areas in which they were born. However, by the 1960s and 70s, one out of every five Americans was moving to a new place of residence each year. With these population shifts, the West and South became the fastest growing sections of the country. In 1963, California passed New York to become the most populous state. Meanwhile, the states of the Northwest were losing population in relation to the rest of the nation.
2. Between 1940 and 1970, the decline of farm population was accompanied by a sharp increase in the urban population. In some years, more than 1 million men and women left the farms to seek better opportunities in the nation's growing urban areas. On the other extreme, the migration out of the older cities into the suburbs was mostly led by young married couples seeking better living conditions for raising their families, and huge suburban housing developments were springing up almost overnight. Department stores and banks were opening branches in the new suburban shopping centers. Many industries were following the people out of the central cities, and city and suburban areas are being tied together by a complex network of highways and superhighways.